Yeah, I think hindsight's always 20/20, right? So we took on a lot of projects as the GC all at once.
This is the South Storage Podcast, where we share the knowledge and skills from the industry's leading investors, developers, and operators to help you launch and grow your South Storage business. Your host, Scott Myers, over the past 18 years has acquired, developed, converted, and syndicated nearly 5 million square feet of South Storage nationwide. With the help of his incredible team at SouthStorageInvesting.com, who has helped thousands of people achieve greatness in South Storage.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Self-Storage Podcast. I am your host, Scott Myers, and in the studio today, we have Jonah Hall with Smart Lock Self-Storage. Jonah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Jonah, we've had a chance to chat a little bit recently, and I'm glad we were able to turn the videos and the microphones on for Storage Nation to hear as well. So before we go any further and dive into some of the topics that we wanted to get into, why don't you tell the folks a little bit about your backstory and how you got into self-storage?
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity. Jonah Hall. I'm from Dallas, Texas area, Garland to be specific, if you know the Dallas area. I got started in self-storage in 2017. I was working for a family office, an oil and gas family that owned quite a bit of retail real estate. And one of their buildings was dark. And in 2018, that was my first conversion project. It was a blessing, obviously, from God to be able to go convert something into storage without any experience on their dime. So I will be forever grateful for that proof of concept that I was able to build with them. After we built the first one, which was very much modeled after the old school version of remote management, the 10 Federals and Storage Express, although they've obviously iterated a lot too, we iterated a lot in the technology stack. And today we're doing something quite a bit different. But we knew we wanted remote management. We knew we wanted something self-service. We wanted the customer to be able to help themselves into the storage facility, not just a rental, but an automated move-in was the concept that we were going for. And it really goes back to even when I was with the family office and managing the retail, a common phrase you hear in net lease retail is mailbox money. We were trying to create mailbox money in self-storage, which has always been a little bit more management intensive than net lease real estate, obviously. And we got pretty close. Obviously, inner workings, there's a lot going on still. But from a customer perspective, it is about as simple as it can get. So since then, we kind of had a fork in the road moment. We could choose self-storage development and go raise money and get into the development game and acquisitions. Or we could have gone down the third-party management road, and we kind of have avoided that so far. We may eventually jump into that as well. But we have raised several different funds and JVs and have a portfolio of about 22 assets today. 15 are open as we speak, maybe 16 as of last week, actually. And the rest should be done sometime between now and Q1.
Well, one of the questions that I had, Jonah, is so very familiar with Storage Express being here in Indianapolis. Jefferson Shreve from the great state of Indiana, I've been able to, you know, over the 20 plus years I've been in, you know, he started several years before I did and saw his model rolled out before the tech really caught up to it. And he used to have just a ring down phone at his sites, and you would go and it was like the bat phone, and you go into the site and he had a little area, small little offices on his facilities with a ring down phone, and you walk in and you just pick it up, and it went to his call center, connected to his call center, and they would rent a unit that way. They would tell the client what unit to go over to. They would open the door, and there was a rental contract in it. They would sign it and then send it back off in a prepaid envelope. So obviously, we've come a long ways since then. So you know, the thought behind that model, or at least the assumption behind that model for the rest of us in the industry, is that okay. He or folks that are running unmanned facilities, you know, they don't like tenants, toilets, trash, and maybe not necessarily employees, but that you perhaps struggle in terms of occupancy because, you know, the kiosk, or at his point, you know, maybe even somebody on the other end of the phone wasn't going to be able to negotiate as well to get somebody in, and they could go down the street. And so you would essentially suffer an occupancy by not having a salesperson in place and replacing that with technology. So Jonah, did you find with that business model that you suffered a little bit in occupancy by not having a salesperson in the office versus a kiosk?
actually quite the opposite. But, you know, hey, props to Jefferson for the innovative way of doing rentals back then. That's impressive. It was only, what, 2016, 17, 18 that we started seeing online rentals really coming out to where people could take advantage of that even through a site link or whatever. But no, it's quite the opposite. And the reason for that, I think, is we're open. We're open when everyone else closes their doors. So when we go to a medium-sized market, and there's, you know, I'm using a medium-sized market because there's no REITs that you're competing against potentially. In those markets, most people close their doors at 5, and maybe they don't even open on Sunday at all. I get half my rentals during those periods of time. And so we're able to stay full. We're able to command better rents because we're actually available when the customer needs us, which is mostly the time after they get off work, not during the middle of the day when they're all at work and they're all doing other things.
Well, so I wanted to give some people some context to how an unmanned facility works first, but I wanted to go back to a little bit regarding your history and where you started and working for a family office. So tell me the point where there was a conscious decision then to look into self-storage. You're in the oil and gas, you're working for a family office and investing in those asset classes, if you will, and looking around the landscape, you could do pretty much anything to invest in, and you landed on self-storage. Can you recall those conversations and what it was that, you know, said, hey, this is a sexy business model that we need to get into. We need to be in self-storage.
You know, it's interesting because they were actually using the 1031 vehicle to switch out of oil and gas assets and into retail real estate. And the reason it was retail is it's readily available, right? It's always on the market. You can always buy a Dollar General or a Walgreens. They're on the market every day. So that's what they had a portfolio of, and that's what I managed both from an asset management standpoint and property management to some degree. I think there was an empty building, and they said, figure out what to do with it. It was losing, I don't know, 10, 12 grand in taxes and another 8 to 12 grand in insurance every year. And they're like, let's do something with this. And I don't really recall why I thought storage, except I have one childhood memory. My mom actually worked in a self-storage office for a while on the weekends. And I had some friends in the business. I remember it being a cash flow business. And so I was like, well, let's figure it out. And at that time, like we mentioned, you know, there were only a couple, like truly a couple in the whole country that were doing it well. And so I just basically, I can copy somebody else. That's not hard. And so that's our first model was really just a copy of what other people had figured out that it worked. I was not reinventing the wheel on the first one at all.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's an industry in which there's a whole lot of innovation anyways. If you try to make your mark on it, it's pretty straightforward. It's a simple, predictable business model. And again, thankfully, for folks like me, I need a simple, predictable business model because I'm not that creative when it comes to business, but I sure can, you know, we can get our processes and our operations down well to compete. But as you're looking at the landscape right now, Jonah, is that... Are we seeing an opportunity again in the marketplace? We just launched a fund that focuses on acquisitions, and we also have a smaller fund that is focusing on conversions. And so essentially how you started the business, looking at some of these dark, vacant big boxes and then converting them and turning them into self-storage. Is now the time that you're looking to do that as well? Or what are the next steps as we head into this next economic cycle?
Yeah, nobody really has a crystal ball, obviously. But if I had to guess, I would say the conversions are going to continue to be around. We see a lot of them. It's not too hard to find a conversion these days, and kind of COVID made sure of that. There's a lot of vacant furniture stores and grocery stores and things like that that we'd like to convert. Ground up, starting to pencil a little bit, to be honest. And so we're starting to look at those. We kind of rule them out through 21 and 22, just cost of construction. I couldn't get them to perform it to the same type of returns. And then, yes, finally, we're seeing a little bit of acquisitions. I think I put my first one under contract last week in a year and a half because we just turned our full attention over to conversions through that time period. When everybody was willing to pay a little too much, I bowed out of that particular aspect of the business and focused on development.
Well, I believe we're finally in that time frame as of the date of this podcast, in which sellers' expectations have now finally caught up to reality and where the market is. And either the brokers have done a good job or they just realize that the appraisers and the lenders aren't going to give them the valuations that they truly feel that their facility is worth, and they're going to have to settle for what the market is bearing. But development, I've been through three recessions now, and I saw what the REITs did the last time around. We were buying everything we could get our hands on in 2009 and 10 and taking advantage of the market. But we saw the bigger players, you know, that had the deeper pockets, they were developing. And those are the folks that end up cleaning house. If you can develop during these times right now, when there's less development and there is a glut of storage, then, you know, 18 months from now, either at C of O or when you begin to lease up, and taking advantage of a low interest rate and low cap rate environment, you know, that is the model. So it seems like there's very few people out there that are looking at that development aside from some of the bigger players. But and Jonah, you're not a large player, but certainly not a small player. So tell us when you came, what were some of the markers in the market itself that said, okay, now's the time to begin building again?
Well, it was actually a reaction to the cap rates, I think. We had just finished our third property, which was an acquisition value add project. Excellent project in mid-2020. And then I had one guy full-time underwriting value add acquisitions, and they just started coming up short. Maybe one every other month instead of five or six a month we wanted to make an offer on. And so we just turned our attention to development. Since then, we've kind of made it our bread and butter. We've built an entire in-house GC around this concept. And so we've got guys that are construction managers and subcontractors, and even an architect in-house that's focused on conversions or adaptive reuse of existing buildings. And that model is very easy to pencil once you know how to do it. It's very interesting to be able to go look at a footprint and know, kind of without even taking a pencil or paper, what kind of revenue you can generate off that property, what you possibly pay for it. And then, of course, you got to have some construction expertise as well to go assess the roof, the HVAC, anything you're not planning to replace on day one. And you know what the useful life of that product is, and know how long you've got before you might need to replace that, put that into CapEx too.
If you can't find yield in the marketplace, then the best place to get it is to build it. And so I think that's when people begin to turn to construction, which we were doing as well. And so what we've seen, and tell me if this is true for you as well, Jonah, when we begin constructing it and penciling out a project, you know, one of the challenges with that, or many of the challenges, is that we weren't able to control the rising construction costs and labor costs. And all of a sudden, we got into contract law with our general contractors a little deeper than we ever had in terms of, you know, signing on an agreement and having escalation clauses and everything built into place. What are some of the lessons that you learned that now make you feel more comfortable entering into, and besides bringing folks back in-house, that makes you feel, you know, more comfortable now that you're not going to be surprised as you get into the middle of a project?
Yeah, I think hindsight's always 20/20, right? So we took on a lot of projects as the GC all at once. So I'm kind of on the flip side of the thing there from you. I was the one signing on to the GMP contracts, right? And that obviously had a lot of risk in the last couple of years. I think all of them are going to come out all right. Most of them are going to come out under budget, which is great. But we had a lot of learning curve, and we had to get creative. So, for example, punch list items were very, very tricky to find in smaller markets. Just could not find a GC willing to do $12,000 worth of work. Just wasn't in their wheelhouse. They had another job in another city that would pay them $100,000. So they were just not willing, or they would get to it when they got to it. And that wasn't going to be acceptable for us. So we had to go create our own subcontractor and hire some actual tradesmen to go out there and do anything from floor grinding to installing cameras or whatever. And we kind of learned where we could find the bottlenecks and fill them ourselves, fill those chinks in the armor, and have since brought an architect in-house. That took a lot of the timeline down, especially in Texas. The timeline for an architect to do a drawing could take 10, 12, 14 weeks last year. And we could turn one around in about a week after closing. And so that really saved us a lot of time and got us into the permitting phase a lot quicker.
Jonah, one of the challenges that I think we're facing right now is, you know, if we're looking to expand the footprint where we currently are in a market, because we already have, you know, our district managers in place, you know, we've got branding and management and marketing hitting those areas. Yet we're bumping into some supply index issues where we begin to see that the markets are becoming a little saturated and oversupplied. How do you go about site selection? Do you just continue to go out farther and farther and find a site that you know that is suitable, that has a low supply index from where you are right now? Or are you essentially market agnostic and you'll go wherever you can find a piece of dirt that has a great market that is right behind it that is starving for storage?
That's an interesting question because it's something we've learned over time. When we first got started, my way of going about that was we would underwrite market. We'd underwrite certain cities, maybe 20,000 people to 80,000 people was sort of small market range. And so we underwrote all those markets and decided, all right, these 50 we would be in tomorrow if we could find either the right conversion product or an existing site we could acquire for the right price. And so we sent people out on the on an effort to go find the local realtors, the local commercial realtor if they had one. A lot of these towns are so small that, you know, the realtors do both commercial and residential, but let them know, hey, here's my buy box. This is exactly what I want in this market. And over time, that paid off. It wasn't instant. Most of the time, they would just kind of, okay, thanks. But you reach out every month or so, and then pretty soon they realize you're real about trying to find something in their market, and they start bringing you stuff. And so we were able to find a lot of buildings that way. So we'd already underwritten the market in that sense. And those are markets that either had no climate control or, you know, less than 1 square foot per capita of climate. And maybe they had a decent amount of non-climate, but it was old, or it was, you know, you have to really look at the quality of what's there. Not just the pricing and not just the total square footage, but really what is the quality of what's available to this marketplace of people? Because the heads are there, you know, there's 30,000 people there and there's, you know, 4,000 square feet of climate. It's not enough for most markets. Unless the market is shrinking, we were pretty interested in those kinds of markets. And so that's where we've ended up. A lot of markets between 15 and 150,000 people, sort of the tertiary market for most states.
And I wonder, as we were at our mastermind last week in Las Vegas, and we have folks that are, you know, all across the spectrum. We have syndicators who are developers. We have syndicators who are focusing on nothing but value add and conversions and everything in between. And then we have a number of contractors and companies that are builders as well. And as we are, you know, at the time of this podcast, we're in the third quarter. And we're at the tail end of all the fall shows, from Vegas to the statewide shows. And all across all our members that are in our mastermind, it seems to be a mixed bag of responses after they come out of the show. Some folks said, this show had nothing but optimism for the industry, and everybody is bullish on storage and they're building and acquiring. And then another group of folks said, we just got back from this show, and it just seems like, you know, everybody was really down and walking around with their head hung low and, you know, really, you know, concerned and pencils down and not buying and not building anything. So do you think that just depends upon perhaps the niche or the area of focus that these companies are in, that if they're, you know, if they're building, they're excited about their prospects, and if they're buying, or is it because they're going into those secondary and tertiary markets like you and finding opportunities there versus, you know, the same old tried and true, you know, maybe urban infill locations? Yeah, you know, what's your take on the whole mixed bag of emotions out there in the marketplace that we're seeing?
It's partially who's on stage talking. Obviously, there are different people have different opinions on everything. So that's always funny to kind of go from literally the same event, one talk to the other, and hear a very different version of that. But yeah, it's partially the product type they're picking too. If you're looking for value add in urban areas right now, good luck. There's not a lot of it. I mean, you're going to have a hard time buying in a basis that gives you the upside you want. But that said, in markets that I'm going into, I continue to find great returns, great yield, and we're excited. We're very, very focused on growth right now, and really want to grow a big portfolio, following the footsteps of some of these large transactions we've seen in the recent past. And that doesn't happen if you're doing 3, 4, 5 deals a year. You really got to start putting your team to work. And so now that we've got a team large enough to actually source deals and get a pipeline of them, it's time to go execute. So it's just a difference of a perspective, I guess, a little bit. But also because we're in better markets for yields right now, we're more excited for the future too.
You know, it's interesting. I've had the honor and the privilege of being on stage with some of the, I think some of the veterans and some of the folks that are very well respected in the self-storage communities. And after talking for a half an hour about, you know, that this market is a flyover, and we're stopped developing over here, we're not buying over there, we're not doing anything, as they're stepping off of stage, they're saying, hey, how's your Denver project going? Where they just said that they were, you know, not working in those markets, or Dallas or what have you. So take it with a grain of salt, as you mentioned, just really depends on, you know, who's on stage and what they're talking about. And I think sometimes it's a deflection to keep other competitors out of their market, maybe. But, you know,
Or a product that they're offering. I've seen a lot of people on stage, you know, they're offering some sort of mezzanine debt. And so, of course, they want you to go help them acquire more in your market. And they act like they're not interested in your market or something like that. I don't know. There's lots of different agendas on stage. So you kind of got to be careful.
Yeah, I think, as they say, many of these events, you learn more by going out to dinner or lunch or coffee with the folks and having one-on-one conversations. And what is said from the stage, and that, and I think that holds true. So Jonah, our focus right now, I think, is mostly on speed. You know, we recognize that, as you mentioned, you can't move at 3, 4, 5 facilities per year, whether it's through acquisition, conversion, or development. If you're looking to grow a portfolio and time the market, if you will, based upon lowering interest rates and lower cap rates to be able to exit, as we talked about. So for you, is that trying to grab and build as big a portfolio as possible? How strategic are you being in placing, you know, your projects and in proximity to one another? You know, what is the overall goal in order to, you know, then meet the market where it is to be able to exit?
Yeah, for sure. I want to build something that's exitable, but I'm also wanting to make sure I build stuff that has good cash flow, that if it doesn't time exactly as we all think it will, that I can coast right through that and come out the other side of well. So I'm not doing bad projects, but I do agree with you that speed is key. I agree with the key that speed is key. And so we think of it two ways, speed in development or acquisitions, however you want to, acquiring more assets, but also speed because of the technology piece that we're pretty excited about. I think the industry is more and more moving towards this kind of tech and lower margins and being able to compete in different times and different places. And so because we've got that already sort of in-house, we're trying to go capture as much and convert it to that as we can. I think here in, I don't know, I'm not going to give it a timeline, 5, 10 years, whatever. There will be a time when if you're not adopting some of the same tech, you're just going to get bought by the people who did. And so we want to kind of be ahead of that curve. And so we're working really hard to make sure we're building a smart portfolio. But no pun intended, a smart portfolio to go with our smart lock platform.
Well, I would agree. And 5 to 10 years, I believe that you know, unmanned or the utilization of tech in the way that even if it isn't the exact way that Smart Lock is utilizing it, if you're not adopting, you definitely are going to fall behind. I think several folks have already recognized that. You just can't afford to. If you want to maximize NOI, you can't have man hours at a facility any longer. It just doesn't work. And so that. And it's not just replacing the person behind the desk, but so many other avenues away, or in so many other avenues where tech is affecting and improving the way that we run this business. You know, that is truly the last frontier, I think, in terms of innovation in this industry. However, that being said, you know, you came into it perhaps a little late, well, definitely later than myself and later than others. And so fresh set of eyes and maybe even being able to see a little further down the road, you know, what is your take on the industry? And where are there other areas in which you think that it is ripe for innovation or other ways of approaching this business model that that you see coming into play in the future?
That's interesting. I do find that I have a weird perspective sometimes. I think I'm right, but you know, that's frankly, my opinion, obviously. I do find that I tend to look at it a little bit differently because I had no self-storage experience 5 years ago and I just drank through the fire hose for the last 5 years. I've been able to just take a different approach. I do think the industry is becoming more automated. That's exciting to me. More technology is going to be good. If you look at every other asset class, they've had technology a lot longer, from restaurants to hotels to whatever, right? And then the other piece of it is it's still so fragmented. Despite all of this consolidation and aggregation that's happening, we still have, half, maybe a little more of the market that's still mom and pops and small operators. If you count the small operators, it's still, you know, probably well over 60% of the market is just ripe for the taking, if you will. And I think there's going to be a lot of people in the next few years that are selling for one of many reasons. Obviously, their loan could have come due at a really bad time, or it could just be an asset passed down to the kids and the kids don't want to manage it, whatever. There's going to be a lot of that. And I hope to be knocking on a lot of those doors.
Yeah, we do know that this is one of the last wild west frontiers in terms of commercial real estate, as you mentioned. I think one of the stats I've seen, depending on how you look at it, 80% is still mom and pop, that is not REIT. And then, you know, bringing closer to that 60%, as you mentioned, would then include the, you know, like regional and national players, but not necessarily the REITs. So unlike all the other asset classes, this is the last of which we were able to see that the greatest opportunity to be able to roll up and then, you know, sell off in tranches, if you will, or just build a large portfolio. And so that's what's got a lot of people excited about the industry. I'm still very bullish on it, and we're doing the exact same things that you're doing, and going fast and being selective. A good deal now is a good deal for later, or to sell either way, just making smart acquisitions and making sure that we're developing and producing to the market what it is always going to want. So, Jonah, that being said, you know, these are very interesting times that we're in right now. And there's a lot of private equity that is pulling back or sitting on the sidelines. There's a lot of developers and investors that are doing the same thing, with the exception of some of the folks like yourself and our organization that are moving forward. But what do you see as perhaps the greatest opportunity, maybe in the short cycle now, within the next 12 to 18 months?
I would say continued refinement of a sort of good business practices. Technology may pay a piece of that, but it's still a hard time to run a business. And so you've got to be good at running this business because it is a business, right? It's not just a real estate investment. So you've got to be good at revenue management. You've got to be good at streamlining processes, and you've got to continue working on that. And then the thing that I'm probably most excited about is I continue to see more capital coming in. You're right, there are people sitting on the sidelines, but there's also all this new kind of mid-size family office, long-term investment, visionary kind of capital that's like, hey, this is good cash flowing. We should just go build a giant portfolio. And so I've met a lot of these people recently, and I can just see that there's a big hunger to take up, what I've been out there advertising, which is there's a lot of mom and pops to go buy up, and there's a lot of development to be had in markets that previously you just couldn't pencil. But because of technology and better processes and vertigrated team and whatever I'm trying to say, vertically integrated teams, you can take advantage of smaller markets, smaller footprints, and still get those same yields and returns.
Yep, I would agree 100%. Well, Jonah, I appreciate so much you taking time out of the busy schedule of moving fast and growing your portfolio to take advantage of the opportunity we see in the marketplace right now. But before we go, what's the best place for people to find out a little bit more about what you are doing?
LinkedIn has been really good. I'm amazed how useful that tool can be. Everything from finding great employees to meeting new people that want to simply ask us a question about what we do, or maybe they want to run a deal by us or something. It's a good place to reach out to me or the team. So LinkedIn is probably where I would point everybody.
Jonah, any good books that you're reading right now, or what is maybe that one book that is continues to surface on the front of your list that you revisit over and over again that you'd like to share with Storage Nation?
Sure. Two books. One I'm reading now is Rocket Fuel. I know a lot of people talk about that book, but man, it is an excellent book. And then the one that's probably been the most impactful, other than maybe the Bible, I guess, but the most impactful business book that I've ever read was Think and Grow Rich. I try to read it every year or two. It's amazing how such an old book can have new meaning every time you read it. So it's an excellent book, and I highly recommend it.
Well, three of my favorites, anything and everything you want to know about business, life, marriage, raising kids, it's all found in the Bible. And Rocket Fuel is fantastic. We revisit that on a regular basis, my integrator and I, and go through that and have regular meetings to make sure we're on the same page. And Think and Grow Rich is, we formed our mastermind just based upon Napoleon Hill, and what he has done is his teachings, and we follow to the letter, what he had brought forth in terms of how to get together with groups of people that are aligned and moving forward together. So, yeah, all three great ones.
Shout out to you on that. That's it's funny because I reread Think and Grow Rich just before I went to your mastermind a year ago or whatever, and it hadn't clicked until I read that book right before the mastermind. I was like, oh, duh. That's directly pulled from the book. That's awesome. So yeah, pretty cool. I'm happy to hear that. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Good stuff. All right, Jonah. Well, with that, once again, thanks so much for your time, and looking forward to catching up on round two. And we get maybe on the backside of this as the portfolio grows and interest rates come down, and we'll see if all came true.
All right. I'm looking forward to it. I'm happy to prove somebody wrong if they vote against me. Thanks, Scott.
All right.
Appreciate
thanks,
it.
My friend. Good to see you, Jonah. Take care.
Hey, gang. Wait, three things before you leave. First, don't forget to follow the South Storage Podcast and turn on your notification so you never miss another episode. And while you're there, please leave us a 5-star review if you like the show. Second, be sure to share your favorite episodes and more via Instagram. And don't forget to tag us. And lastly, head to the links in the show description and hit follow on Twitter and Facebook to get a front row seat as we grow and scale our business and bring you along with us.